Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 4th of April. Coming up on the programme, the Speaker of the House quits. What now? What does this development specifically mean for the African National Congress? Is the pension fund industry ready for the two-pot system now that the bill has been passed? Does government have a plan to mitigate the expected weather-related maize price pressures? And why are we moving so slowly on the phasing out of canned lion hunting? Well, you'll be well aware that Parliament's Speaker has left the building, so to speak, saying that her resignation is in no way an admission of guilt. So what now for Nazeviwe Mapisa-Nqakula? Let's begin our coverage with Moloto Motapo, who speaks for Parliament. Welcome to you and thanks very much for joining us. Very quickly, can you explain to me how the process unfolded and what advance warning you were given about her decision?
Yeah, you will recall that I think it's about a week or so, 2 weeks ago, the Speaker of the National Assembly took a decision to take a leave of absence in terms of the rules of the National Assembly from Parliament, from her position as the Speaker of the National Assembly, given the personal hardships that she is confronted with, as we all know by now. And Parliament immediately put in place the systems to ensure that the work of the House continues uninterrupted, and amongst others, in terms of the Constitution, in terms of the rules, the Deputy Speaker of the National Assembly automatically became the Acting Speaker of the National Assembly. So she has been out of action, I think, for the past 2 weeks, until, of course, yesterday, given in light of the developments in these personal hardships, that she decided and she saw it fit to completely cut ties with the institution. And as she has correctly explained in her statement, to guard the integrity and the reputation of the institution, including the office of the Speaker, and to ensure that whatever that she's going through, whatever the developments in this challenges that she is going through, do not drag Parliament along. So it's of course, these are the decisions, Jeremy, that at this stage of the challenges that she's going through can only be made by the person who is holding that position, which is herself. Mm. And from Parliament's side, I think it is important that the institution is insulated from all these problems. And for that, I think she must be commended.
To what extent do you think the integrity of the institution has been compromised?
Well, it is never easy, Jeremy, when you have the head of the institution, especially the head of the National Assembly, being confronted with this kind of challenges. It is a challenging, not only for herself. Obviously, she is undergoing tremendous deal of hardship, challenges, and pain. But of course, it is inevitable that Parliament will be seen, given the relationship and the key position that she holds within the institution. It is inevitable that there will be some kind of an impact on the reputation of Parliament. I think that is the reason why, and she was mindful of that, and that is the reason why she has taken very timely steps to ensure that the institution and the position and the office of the Speaker of the National Assembly is insulated and protected to the best extent possible that she could be able to.
So it will be incumbent upon your office now and the acting speaker's office to make sure that that reputation is now repaired. What are you going to do?
Well, like I'm saying, it is a difficult period, and I don't think that it is something that we can blame it on her. These are the kind of things that from time to time the institution and people who hate these institutions go through. But these institutions, Jeremy, are very resilient. We have gone through so much difficulty. As you know, Parliament is a center of the political battles and political struggle, if you can say. It's a center of political contestation. So it is inevitable that the institution will undergo perceptions of one form or another over a period of its existence. We are continuously monitoring the public perception on annual basis regarding the work that we are doing, and we know where these perceptions come from, and we are always putting together certain interventions in order to minimize and to manage any negativity that might be projected upon the institution.
Moloto Motapa, could you clarify for me what you mean when you say you cannot blame this on her?
No. I'm saying that the institution by its nature goes through difficulty on ongoing basis. So there are things that people will perceive the institution on the basis of certain developments, politically or otherwise, within and outside of the institution. The issues of, for instance, state capture, they have got an impact on the perception and the reputation of the institution. I will tell you now that the long work that the institution has done in through the Ad Hoc Committee on the inquiry into the former public protector, it also had an impact. There will be perceptions, negative and sometimes positive, regarding that. So I'm just saying that there are a number of examples that I can give that an institution of this nature, where there is a high level of political contestations and engagement on ongoing basis, there will be such kind of an impact on the reputation of the institution. Ours is to ensure that we insulate the institution from such kind of perceptions or reputational damage, and to continuously build positive perceptions of the institution in the eyes of the public.
All right, Moloto Motapa, thank you very much indeed. He speaks for Parliament. So by resigning, the now ex-National Assembly Speaker has, according to some, saved her party embarrassment. It would have been forced to defend her in the DA's motion of no confidence debate. Listening into that conversation and with more details, political commentator T.K. Pue. T.K., a very warm welcome to you. You've been listening into the conversation with Moloto Motapo. We were talking a little earlier about the impact on the integrity of Parliament, and you were suggesting to me that this is something that has been ongoing for the past decade or so.
Yes, in two ways. One, it's also the ineffectiveness of, I think, Parliament to actually get to core issues such as corruption, and the way that it's almost been weaponized, in the sense that the ANC, because of its majority, has been able to obfuscate many things. And then secondly, the former Speaker's actual case has been going on for the longest time, I think over a decade or so. So the key question what we need to ask, and I think must not be forgotten, is how was she allowed to ascend to that position? And I think that's quite the problematic thing.
So in other words, due diligence wasn't done.
Yes, and that wording kind of describes Parliament, especially when it comes to the major issues of South Africa, when it comes to corruption and governance, the inability to actually practice due diligence.
All right, the resignation itself, is it a strategic move to maintain the ANC's image and protect its interests rather than an act of accountability?
It is strategic. It's almost a great fodder for campaigning, because really you have to remember, during campaigning, it's not necessarily the truth that comes out. It's more the optics of we look great. We look like we're actually doing the renewal of the ANC. So it does look like great optics. So there's nothing really more to it.
So the response from the opposition parties and the ANC's alliance partners to the resignation, I guess, also reflects perhaps issues within the broader political landscape of South Africa. And again, it brings that debate back to how we deal with accountability and expectations of accountability.
No, that's exactly it. And I think, look, going into whatever the outcome of this government is, and the key issue I look at it is to say, look, Parliament is going to be in charge of a dwindling resource in terms of cash for the country. We need better forms of accountability. And if the governing party is still even the majority, even if it's in a coalition or otherwise, there needs to be, I think, a greater emphasis on saying, listen, deal with these things quicker so that people overseas who want to invest in this country, and also South Africans, can actually see that you're taking this seriously. Because if we go through another round of this in the new parliament, I only see us, kind of stressing the fact that, look, it looks like we don't know what to do when the mechanisms and processes are already there in place. It's not an issue that mechanisms and processes aren't in place. It's a fact that it would seem as though when those in power really don't want to, when it comes to, I want to say, looking after themselves, they'd rather look after themselves and look after the country. And you can't do that in the context that we're South Africa. As I said, we've got limited resources going forward.
Do you think that this then is perhaps a positive precedent-setting move in terms of applying parliamentary progress in the handling of similar cases in the future, should they arise?
I think it's only positive if we see that this becomes the norm. I remember the last discussion we had. I said, look, the former speaker, politically, she's not a heavyweight. So it really doesn't really cost the ANC much in terms of it's not answering to Labour. It's not answering to a particular province in South Africa, which would have made this an earth-shattering thing. It's just the fact that, look, she was already on the way out. So it's just maybe expediting the way out. Now, if this becomes the norm, yes, it could be a positive thing. But unfortunately, I don't see where this becomes the norm going forward, because we really need to set an example of a heavyweight being forced to resign. And unfortunately, that's not really been the precedent in South Africa, even among opposition parties, where we do this, it's called a song and dance for the let's try hold on for the longest time. We don't simply say, listen, resigning to sort out your issues, it's not even an admission of guilt. It's simply just saying you are putting an institution or you're putting citizens' needs forward so that you don't become the drama, and rather the issues of the day become the drama.
Always cutting to the chase of it. Commentator TK Puer, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Let's talk about climate now. And hotter than usual weather in crop-growing regions in South Africa means that maize products are going to be more expensive. I guess that is inevitable. There's always the issue as well of food security. Let's discuss that in a little more detail now, as we're in conversation with Dr. Sifiso Ntombela, advisor to Thoko Dadiza, who is the Minister of Agriculture. Dr. Ntombela, welcome. So just how worried are you?
Certainly, the department is concerned about the changes of weather, especially the intensifying heat wave, which has affected some of the crop yields, which we were very optimistic late last year. As you might recall, that we actually expected drier weather conditions before the planting season. But fortunately, during that time, we had very good rains, which actually stimulated the farmers to plant over 4 million hectares across the country. So we really had a very good season till in the last few months, starting in January, where things started to go a bit difficult for farmers. So the department is certainly concerned, especially after the Crop Estimate Committee, which is the committee that looks at the stock level as well as the growth of maize and the expected harvest, committed by industries as well as government, which has now, to a certain extent, started to put some numbers and showing that how much we could expect tariff. About 20% of what we planted could literally be not realized because of these changing weather conditions.
And Dr. Ntumbela, this is obviously going to have an impact on the price of maize products.
Certainly. And I think maybe for the listener at home, as you know, maize, we've got two type of maize in broadly, the white maize and the yellow maize. The white maize being the one that is usually used for the human consumption and the other one for the animal feed. And I think what we have seen is a proportionally higher impact on the white maize side, which tends to affect the consumption for humans. But fortunately, South Africa is also a country with very sophisticated storage facilities. So we do have some sort of reserve from a good season that we had last year. So while the stock level might be affected with the changes, but the ability to meet the domestic demand and to a larger extent the regional demand, we're almost certain that we will be able to do so.
But that we've seen the market reserve, starting to react. That reserve, Doctor, is not going to last forever, though, is it?
Fortunately, because maize is an annual crop, so we usually post-trade that for the annual season up until the next season, hoping that we start putting measures that will ensure we safeguard the farmers and business continuity in the next season. But for this season, I can say that there is very strong confidence that the country will have sufficient maize, including the reserve, as well as what we'll still harvest. Remember, we're still going to harvest relatively good quality in some areas, even though there's an expected reduction, but overall it will be sufficient to meet the demand. What we're seeing, Jeremy, is that it's starting to knock on the prices, you rightfully said. When you're looking at the premium between the yellow maize and the white maize, it's already about 1,000 rand differences in the past month, which is relatively high. That will start having impact down the line also on the affordability of the white maize meal in the market.
Given, as you've mentioned, a 20% decrease in harvest expectations, then how are farmers, and particularly small-scale and subsistence farmers, now being supported? They must be very anxious.
Certainly they are. But not only just the small-scale farmers, even the commercial farmers to that extent. We are aware that the minister 2 weeks back has already briefed the cabinet and tried to solicit some of the decision required at the government level to put measures to support farmers. Very soon, they will be now engaging with farmer organizations, including small-scale farmer representatives, large-scale farmers, but also the input suppliers and other service providers in the sector to say what are the short-term measures that can be put immediately to safeguard these farmers and ensure that they continue being in business, but also certainly ensuring that beyond this planting season, those farmers that are severely impacted, because the proportionality of the farmers across the country is different. So we must be able to have not just a blanket approach into support, but a tailor-made according to the different region and the scale of farmers, so that you are able to support them now, as well as make sure that we'll be supporting them. And I'm sure, Jeremy, together with the listeners and your viewers, that once that session has been implemented and basically the rollout of those measures will come at the right time between the minister and the different captains of the industries.
What type of thought is being given to diversifying the sources of staples in South Africa's food supply chain?
As you will know, South Africa, in comparison with any other developing country, as well as the African countries, sit at a relatively better position because of the skill set that we have according to our farmers, as well as the policy framework that we've put in place during the reforms in 1996-1998 period. First and foremost, we have a very relatively good trading instrument, as well as the platforms to able to source any shortage of food that we might encounter. We have trade agreements we have secured with almost every region across the world. But also we do have infrastructure, and currently there are those engagements will be upscale in ensuring that our ports does give a priority in case we might need to use our port and reserve some of the food that are coming in into the country at a short notice. And that already being put in place to ensure that we deal with those inefficiencies in the port level, but also on our silos, which we have those storages across the country that will assist on that one. So that's the first thing. The second part of it is really around ensuring that, because we know that these disasters and these changes on climate are not going to go away anytime soon because of the change in climate. And building on the lesson learned, you will recall that South Africa was in a far worse situation than we are now in the 2015-2016 period. So we are really looking at some of those measures and ensuring that how do we even assist with farmers in terms of the payment arrangements if there is a need for that, so that they are also able to access cheaper loans, but also accessing drought-resistant cultivars. There are already some advanced research at the Agriculture and Research Councils which are dealing with seed multiplication. But there's a last point before I step out on this one, Jeremy. We also have a country, because our policy framework have allowed some of the international seed suppliers and producers in the country, which are having investment. One of those are sitting around in Gauteng areas, some of it in the Free State, which are looking at the seed cultivars that are suitable to the changing South African environment to build a resilient sector and ensure that farmers do have access into this going forward, and we diversify our food basket to align to the changing climate.
And I'm going to thank you for joining me on MoneyWeb at Midday, Dr. Sifiso Ntombela. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at Midday, for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you'll be aware the National Assembly has passed the Pension Funds Amendment Bill, the first step to change the pension fund system in South Africa to the so-called two-pot retirement system. What does that mean? Well, it gives members access to a small portion of their retirement savings. So where to now? Caroline Naylor-Wren joins me, Chief Executive Officer of 10X. Caroline, welcome to you. So what then are the next steps for pension funds and administrators to ensure the success implementation, given that there has been concern expressed previously that the time frame is very condensed?
Hello, Jeremy. Yes, the industry's been waiting for a while in terms of having the Pensions Fund Amendment Bill passed by the National Assembly. So we're pleased that they have taken that step. In terms of what happens next, we need the President to sign it into law, but we are confident that that will come in ahead of the planned implementation date on the 1st of September. So as a pension provider, 10X and many of the other industry players, we've known this has been coming for a while. So we have been already preparing ourselves and developing systems and processes to handle the change.
Are those systems and processes ready should the bill be signed in the timeframe that you're suggesting?
Yeah, absolutely. There's obviously a little way to go still, and I'm sure some providers are still busy doing testing and final preparations. But from our perspective, there's plenty of time before September to be ready.
Caroline, the big concern, of course, is rush on funds. And are there systems or processes in place that would mitigate the risk of members depleting their savings prematurely? And one would hope that safeguards are in place in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, the new regulations are going to allow people to make one withdrawal a year from their savings pot. So that savings pot will contain a third of all of their new contributions that they've made to the pension. So there is the risk of people wanting to take that money out. From Penix's perspective, the safeguards that we are putting in place is to ensure that if members do want to take their money out, that first of all, they understand the implications of that, and secondly, that we speak to them and we explain their options and we explain the unintended consequences of taking their money out before retirement.
Do you think that people have been sufficiently informed about the potential risks?
No, I think as an industry, we need to do more, and certainly at 10X, we try and make it as simple to understand as possible. But the consequences of taking that money out, not only are you going to be taxed as taxable income, but long-term consequences that you'll never be able to save that money up again, and you've lost the growth over the 15 to 20 years before your retirement, means that you could end up at retirement with a significantly less amount of money than you should have had.
Caroline, my understanding is that this is a triangular relationship. One is you have the pension fund, you have the consumer, then of course you have the tax man. And given the necessity of SARS's readiness to process all the tax components of payouts under the system, do you think sufficient measures have been taken to ensure a smooth coordination between funds such as yourself and the tax authorities?
I don't have any insight in terms of the readiness at SARS, but what I do know is that the industry and National Treasury and SARS have been in communication for a long time. These changes have been under discussion for a number of years. So I think, like us, SARS will have known about this, that it's coming, and will have been making preparations in advance.
All right, thank you very much for joining me. That's Caroline Naylor-Wren, who's the Chief Executive Officer of 10X.
MoneyWeb at Midday, for all your up-to-date stories.
If I've read my calendar correctly, 2 years have passed since the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment announced its intention to phase out captive lion hunting. But progress has been slow, according to the global animal welfare organization Four Paws, who fear government is showing signs of not knowing how to deliver this phase out. Well, let's talk now to Kamala Senchetti, chairperson of the Ministerial Task Team on the captive lion industry. Kamala Sen, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. 2 years is a long time. Has sufficient progress been made?
Sure. Thank you very much, Jeremy, and good day to you and your listeners. I think 2 years, it's a very, very complex industry. It's had a long history since the 90s. And, you know, there's some 7,800 odd lions and 342 facilities that have come out from our audit. Essentially, the complexities is that this is a legal business. It's been allowed to thrive and grow. However, it's inconsistent with the global norms. So globally, you could understand that there was strong resistance to the Isle Bay industry, there's strong resistance to the fur industry, beauty without cruelty, and so on. And these days, increasingly, with social media and others, you know, society is becoming more and more socially conscious. The whole, you know, environmental, social, and governance movement is on the rise that is impacting on
business.
Which
necessitates the imperative for you to speed up the process, which, according to this organization, for instance, you're simply not doing. You are way behind the delivery curve.
Sure, sure. In order to do so, there's a large amount of regulatory, you know, regulatory issues that have to be addressed.
Such as
which
what?
So laws have, there's no laws to be able to outlaw the industry. It's constitutionally enshrined to exist. And so what we've had is we've had a high-level panel report that came out. This report recommended the closure of the industry. And what Minister Creasy did was do two things in parallel. Her department on her own has put together the legislative process, which has been approved by Cabinet just last week. But in parallel, we've asked industry, and this is where I come in as a chairperson of this committee, is to look at those particular facilities that want to voluntarily exit so that we can provide more certainty in their business life.
And what about the ones that don't?
So the ones that don't would remain. However, the regulations will continue to affect them. The future regulations will continue to affect them. And what the department has done, which has been approved by Cabinet, they've put together a bill that effectively will start the process for outlawing that. So essentially, the process, you have to follow a due diligence process. The process includes public participation, from a range of different stakeholders. Two, once that's gone through, then the bill itself gets adjusted and it's given to Parliament, and it goes through the parliamentary processes in the National Assembly as well as in the National Council of Provinces.
Mr. Chetty, I acknowledge that you have to go through process, but while this is taking such a long time, the reality of the situation, and you will concede this, is that this country's reputation as a leader in wildlife conservation has been irrevocably tarnished.
Yeah. Look, the reputational issues certainly concern me, but I think the approach that we've adopted, you know, any new laws, particularly when it affects the constitutional right of certain businesses, would take an inordinately long time. And there would be a lot of conflict and tensions. So there's a two-pronged process here, Jeremy. On the one hand, we're trying to ask those particular and will incentivize those particular businesses that want to voluntarily exit. We secondly will stall the growth. So one of the pieces of legislation that came through was that no new facilities will be registered. And this is a prohibitory clause that has come through in the past year. And the next phase is a legislative process to try and close down the industry in line with what the high-level panel was saying.
Which begs the question then, Mr. Chetty, and it's a final one, time is against us. Give me a time frame.
So, look, the best time frame to go through all the legislation is 2 years, right? In the meantime, we will make a dent in the industry to the voluntary exit process. And also there is, remember, there's no new approvals for similar businesses.
So another 2 years at least is what you're saying?
At least, at minimum.
Thank you very much for joining me, Kamala Sanchetti, chairperson of the Ministerial Task Team on the captive lion industry. On our online poll yesterday, better than expected revenue collection from SARS, we reported on that. I asked you if a corner has been turned, more compliance or stronger leadership at the institution. 48% of our respondents saying that the country has become more compliant. Today on our online poll, the House Speaker resigns. That's our big story. Three options to vote on: no choice, damage already done, or Parliament's integrity is still intact. Go to MoneyWeb on Twitter X or on our LinkedIn page, MoneyWeb at Midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.